Hello, welcome to the Roundhouse Podcast. This is Paul Sollentrop of Wichita State University Strategic Communications. Today we have Corey Torgerson, Associate Athletic Director for Compliance. The theme of today's podcast would be everything is fluid and nothing is simple. But we are going to attempt to walk Shocker fans through some of the what's been going on from an NCAA perspective and how that might affect Wichita State, what might be most interesting to fans. And again, everything is fluid and nothing is simple. Let's start by giving you an introduction to Corey Torgerson. Started at Wichita State in 1995. Corey, you were assistant basketball coach at Bethany from 1990 to 94. Why did you decide reading the NCAA rules manual was more fun than teaching people how to shoot jump shots? That question seems to loom today.
I don't know that I decided that. I think that when I was hired as an intern or graduate assistant here, I was working for Dr. Darlene Bailey at the time, and we were getting ready to go through NCAA certification and was really kind of helping out all areas of the department, but with a focus on NCAA certification. And eventually, as time went on, I think that Darlene and then Becky Endicott saw that I might be a good fit in the athletic student services area. And so when I moved down to that office in 1998, it was with some academic responsibilities, you know, helping Gretchen in that area a little bit, but also dabbling into compliance. One of the reasons to move me to that area was that was about the time that student athlete employment legislation changed to allow student athletes to work off campus. The rule that kind of passed at the time was a full ride student athlete, once they were on campus for 1 year, then in the years following, they could make up to $2,000 up and above a full grant in aid. And so I think they decided that I might be helpful in that area. So, you know, my time in that area kind of evolved from academics and compliance to really focusing on the compliance area, and that focus probably began in the early 2000s, and so that's where we are today. I think it was, I don't know if it was so much that something that I decided to do is it kind of maybe fell into my lap, and I think others saw that that could be an area of strength for me, so it's kind of where we are.
Do you have a book, a Netflix series, a movie recommendation for all of us who are starved for entertainment during this pandemic? What's been on your plate?
My plate has been trying to find a hobby. I don't have very many hobbies other than navigating my kids to the different places in Wichita for sporting practices and games. So I think the hobby that we have tried to pick up as a family is we've been doing some fishing. So haven't really watched a lot of Netflix. I know that, you know, my son has, even before the pandemic, has watched all of The Office. He'll be a freshman in high school next year. He's really been into Grey's Anatomy, and he's now on the new season that was just released last week. Dina, my wife, has been watching All American as a recommendation of the kids. I think the kids have probably watched some or all of Tiger King. I think I've watched one episode, but I haven't really watched a lot of TV during this time. That's been pretty busy with work and trying to stay updated and communicating with coaches more than anything regarding the daily, weekly changes with NCAA rules.
I'm contractually obligated to ask everybody what they're watching on Netflix, so I appreciate that. We should tell people about your wife, Dina. Give us the background on her, former great Shocker athlete.
Dina is a former Shocker great, was a graduate of Shawnee Heights High School in Topeka and came to Wichita State in 1992 to, for track and field, but really wanted to play basketball too. So she played basketball for Linda Hargrove for 4 years from 92 to 96 and threw the javelin and ended up having a six-year career due to some medical issues, but was an All-American javelin thrower at Wichita State.
Which did you enjoy more, the 2015 Royals or the 2019 Chiefs?
I would say the 2015 Royals. I grew up in Texas. I lived in Texas from 72 to 82, moved there from Iowa shortly after I was born, and actually grew up a Royals fan in Texas, I think in large part due to Georgia Brett. And so, you know, then moved to Kansas in 1982 and lived in Baldwin City for 3 years. So was able to go see some Royals games and have been a long-suffering Royals fan. And I think that the Royals was more enjoyable just because I think it was very unexpected. And to see the run they went on in 2014 and to be able to repeat that in 2015 was pretty awesome.
I agree. I've missed the same feelings. All right. Name, image, and likeness is probably something fans have heard a lot about. Detailed topic, a lot of avenues, a lot of ins and outs. Give us the basics. What would Shocker fans need to know about where this is?
So probably, you know, two of the things that we're going to discuss today are name, image, and likeness, and then with respect to the transfer waiver, those are the name, image, likeness issue has been an ongoing topic for probably 3, 4, or 5 years at this time, you know, in large part due to, you know, some litigation that has been in the courts, you know, mainly in California, you know, kind of involving Ed O'Bannon and other cases. But it's become an even more hot topic as you have seen state legislatures draft name, image, likeness legislation to allow student athletes to use their name, image, likeness and profit off of it. And because of the action by states, it has really forced the NCAA to delve into that issue more and really to develop concepts and eventually legislation with respect to the name, image, and likeness. And so the space that we're in right now is the NCAA has developed some concepts, which we will hit here shortly. And then, you know, we're expecting that based upon these concepts, the legislation will actually be in a draft form this summer. We hope maybe as soon as June, but I would suspect by August for sure. You know, and just looking at some of the concepts, you know, under the heading of student athlete athletically and non-athletically related business activities, you know, some bullet points underneath that headline would be that institutions may not be involved in these activities. No institutional marks may be used. And then institutions would not be permitted to purchase a student athlete's product or service.
I think the part about institutional marks is important, and it's something I didn't really think about until I started reading about it. So, and again, I guess this is still all legislation, but that would mean if we're expecting to see, you know, Joe, basketball player, in an ad for a car lot, it's not going to be wearing Shocker gear.
Correct. They would not be able to use, according to the concepts, be wearing Wichita State gear in that type of activity. They would be in street clothes. They would not, you know, be able to wear gear that identifies themselves as a Wichita State student athlete.
And so we're in the developing this proposal. How soon might it take effect? Do we have a feel for that?
The expectation is that the legislation will be written, and we'll see it in legislative form this summer, and we would expect that a vote would take place at the NCAA convention in January. So it would become effective, I believe would be August 1 of probably 2021, so it would be next summer. You know, so under some of the areas regarding student-athlete athletically and non-athletically related business activities, you know, one area would be fee-for-lessons, camps, and clinics. You know, currently Wichita State student-athletes can do a fee-for-lesson. You know, if somebody were to contact them in the community about, hey, will you give my kid tennis lessons or golf lessons, they can currently do that. You know, they need to be paid the going rate, but they cannot use their name, image, and likeness to promote the fact that they can do these. So basically, as of right now, if it's happening, it's happening by word of mouth because they're not able to advertise the fact that, you know, that they can do, they can give lessons. So that would be one area of change. You know, with that, you know, we don't think that institutional facilities would be able to be used with a fee for lesson, and that's what the current legislation is that a student athlete, if they are doing fee for lessons, they cannot be using Wichita State facilities with those lessons.
So in the past, it's been pretty common after a Wichita State basketball player would graduate, they may have a camp. Landry Shaman has done it, you know, a lot. Mm-hmm. Now you're saying there may be the potential for them to do that when they're a junior and say, come to Ron Baker's basketball camp, that kind of thing.
Correct. Okay. You know, basically allowing them to use their ability, their knowledge, you know, in their sport to, you know, make money off of that, to profit off of that.
Are there misconceptions out there that it would be helpful to talk about?
Probably, you know, not along the camps and clinics piece. I mean, I think another area under the athletically and non-athletically related business activities would be, you know, a concept that is would be the sale of memorabilia owned by the student athlete. This would permit student athletes to sell items that they own, including awards for participation, championships, or special achievements. You know, schools would not be permitted to provide institutional items for the primary purpose of sale by the student athlete. You know, some questions and issues in that area that, you know, we discussed as recently this week on a call with my colleagues in the American Athletic Conference is, you know, we, all of us as institutions are, and departments issue them gear. So when does it become their gear? Meaning, you know, when could they sell it? You know, we talk about an institution not being involved in some of these activities. Well, as an institution, if we're the ones issuing them the gear, then how are we not involved in that activity if they're able to sell, you know, some of their gear? You know, and then what legal action would a university take if the student athlete takes and sells the gear? And so, you know, at this point, I think, you know, as we look for the drafting of the legislation to come out, is having it defined, you know, when a student athlete is able to sell that gear. Because right now, if a student athlete were to sell gear that that's been issued to them by the athletic department before their eligibility has expired, that would be a violation of NCAA rules. And so, you know, we'll be looking for more direction, you know, in that area as this legislation gets drafted. You know, another opportunity that student athletes may be able to take advantage of is, you know, one of the concepts is autographs and permitting a student athlete to be paid for his or her autograph on items that he or she owns and so forth. You know, currently Wichita State or any student athlete cannot sell, you know, pictures of themselves or autographs. You know, as we have seen with men's basketball, when they have expired their eligibility, you know, when Tad Sports Locker was in business, it was very common for Tad's to invite some of those seniors, you know, to his shop to sign autographs, and they would get paid for something like that. And so that could, you know, that may be an opportunity down the road with this legislation that a student athlete could take advantage of, you know, as this legislation goes into legislative form.
I think at some point over the last few months, you and I talked about the educational component to this as far as giving a, you know, whoever, a basketball player, a track athlete, you know, experience in how do you market things, how do you market yourself, how do you market your ability. And I think Fred Van Vliet's probably the great example of that, the things he did after he got out of Wichita State with clothing and his story and all those kind of things. So how much of that as a applied learning laboratory, you are a great softball shortstop, what can you do with that while you're in college and learning as a, you know, as a business student? How much of that is this a, is a part of this discussion?
I think it's a big part, and I think that's going to be a big part of what we do as an athletic department and across the country this year, is educating our student athletes about the name, image, and likeness. You know, one of the questions that has come out of this discussion is, you know, the impact of Title IX on this legislation. And in all the conversations that I've been a part of or listening to podcasts, the female student athlete is going to have as much of an opportunity to use this legislation and benefit from it as the male student athlete. You know, there are companies out there that, you know, have been delving into this type of activity of helping, you know, student athletes in the future. You know, a lot of it is along the side, is because of social media. And really, where I think that you will see student athletes take advantage of the name, image, and likeness is going to be in the social media space. You know, influencers on Instagram, YouTube, you know, and other platforms. And, you know, in listening to some of the experts, you know, the people that are in this industry right now, I think that's where they see the student athlete being able to take advantage of this legislation, is in that social media space.
Yeah, that's an interesting aspect of this. So you are saying you have an Instagram account and you can wear a brand of clothing, you can hold up a soft drink, all those kind of things, and you can make money doing those kind of things.
Yeah, I think you potentially could. I mean, and obviously as a social media influencer, it depends upon, you know, the amount of followers you have, and obviously the product. You know, I think that, you know, a lot of times we think that it's going to be, you know, the quarterback or some of the skill positions in football that are going to take advantage of this. Well, you know, I think that you've seen, you know, if you look on social media accounts of other student athletes, male or female, you know, that have, you know, are very active in their community, you know, they have as big of a following as, you know, some of your people that you normally think about with respect to the skill positions in football, or, you know, your really good players on the basketball court. You know, I think some of your Olympic sport athletes, you know, will be able to take advantage of this as much of, you know, as the people that you normally think about with respect to football, basketball, and so forth.
Because they, if they are able to tell an interesting story, put out interesting content, they may be able to attract a following within their, you know, their smaller area,
yeah,
I guess.
For sure. And, you know, I think with the, you know, we started the education process with respect to name, image, and likeness or branding, I would go back to probably the 2011, 12, 13 space when we became more active as an athletic department in that social media world. I think that's the time where we started to bring in, you know, outside experts on social media to talk to student athletes about, you know, this is how you can use this effectively. You know, really social media has kind of become an individual's brand. And so talking to them about branding, how you brand yourself and, you know, and what you put on social media really plays a lot into building your brand. And I know that, you know, our strategic communications office in this department talks to our student athletes on a yearly basis about those aspects. You know, I know that, you know, particularly Caleb Landing will go to our freshman orientation class and talk about branding and social media and engaging, you know, sharing the information that we post as a department. But, you know, how can you as a student athlete engage yourself and engage yourself with the fans?
What kind of, I guess I'll use the word guardrails or limits, or, you know, how does Wichita State figure into this as far as approval, disapproval of some of these opportunities?
Well, guardrail is a is a word that NCAA has really used, and I think those are some of the things that, you know, we're still trying to figure out. I mean, there are, you know, there are potential areas of conflict. You know, is it going to be up to the NCAA or up to the institution with respect to guardrails regarding student athletes potentially getting involved in promotion of things that may involve sports wagering or alcohol and tobacco, things that the NCAA has tried to stay away from? You know, I think other guardrails or other areas of conflict can be disclosure. You know, when will a student athlete be required to disclose to an institution that, you know, they may be engaging with a business regarding name, image, and likeness activities, and what does that entail, and how does that, you know, is it, if it's with a company that the institution or the athletic department has a relationship with, you know, is the institution or department's contract with the company, is that going to be in conflict with any type of contract that a student athlete may be signing with a company?
I'm glad you mentioned social media. That it will be a big part of this, I'm sure, and I kind of skipped over that. Okay, the NCAA Division I Council voted Wednesday to allow voluntary on-campus athletic activities to resume in football, men's and women's basketball starting June 1. What's that mean for Wichita State?
Well, we're still trying to figure that out, and I think departments across the country are. So with them indicating that voluntary activities can occur, you know, for us, you know, in football and basketball, we're talking more about basketball. That could mean – that our returning student athletes could be back on campus and could potentially lift in the weight room. They could come into one of our facilities and shoot baskets. You know, we're still waiting for clarification on whether those voluntary activities could include new student athletes, you know, the individuals that signed a national letter of intent, whether it be last fall or this spring. You know, we hope that by the end of tomorrow, you know, or by the end of the day, Friday, May 22nd, we hope to have more clarification. You know, there's been a lot of discussion about required summer access. And so required summer access can occur in the sports of football and basketball.
What's required?
You know, so required summer access would be, you know, practice in the summer. So in the sport of basketball, they can have 4 hours of strength and conditioning activities and then 4 hours of practice or skill instruction. You know, normally those activities really at Wichita State coincide with our 8 weeks of summer school, which 8 weeks of summer school starts on June 1st. But there's been, you know, direction by the Football Oversight Committee to recommend that football summer access not start until July 1st. And it sounds as though that the Men's Basketball Oversight Committee also feels the same way. So, you know, the summer access, the required activities may not begin until July 1st. You know, we're kind of waiting, you know, maybe if it's not the end of this week, it might be next week when decisions are made in that area. But, you know, I think right now the focus is the voluntary activities. And not only in basketball, but, you know, questions have been brought up of what about voluntary activities in your other sports? You know, in the sports of golf, tennis, and track, your individual sports. You know, now that our spring semester is over, as of last week, finals are over, you know, during a normal time outside of a pandemic, if a student athlete wanted to go play 18 holes of golf with their coach or go to the tennis court and hit with their tennis coach, if the request was made by the student athlete, they could do that. But as of right now, you know, that is not permissible. You know, we're waiting for the Division I Council or the Council Coordination Committee to give us, you know, more direction on that. You know, we hope by the end of the day on Friday, May 22nd. If not, you know, it might be next week.
Immediate eligibility for transfers. Where is the NCAA on that?
With respect to, you know, the transfer waiver working group, you know, going back to last October, the board of directors at the NCAA directed the council to appoint a working group to conduct a comprehensive review of the four-year transfer waiver process. The waiver process was designed to accommodate student athletes who need to transfer schools due to extenuating and extraordinary circumstances that have been outside of their control. Now, this environment has has become unsustainable. You know, the amount of transfer waivers that have been filed over the past couple of years, you know, really when we're talking about that, the five sports that currently do not have the one-time transfer waiver exception would be football, men's and women's basketball, ice hockey, and baseball. So in those five sports, as of right now, technically, when you transfer, you need to sit a year in residence before you can become eligible. And so, you know, going back to October, the board of directors gave, you know, kind of a directive to do, hey, we need to do a review of this four-year waiver or this four-year transfer process, you know, transferring from one four-year school to another. And so, you know, based upon, you know, their work, you know, there was a recommendation by this committee, I want to say earlier this winter, might have been in February, that time frame of, they were almost recommending to modify this waiver process to allow a one-time transfer waiver to occur, you know, with some parameters. You know, and I think because of that, you know, it's been because of a lack of confidence in the existing waiver process. You know, some of the things that have been noted is that there's been a lack of transparency on the basis of waiver outcomes, you know, the confidentiality of decisions, the rationale of that. Obviously, a lot of these waivers have involved medical information, and obviously that type of information is not going to be released. You know, some of the other issues with the current waiver process as it has stood is that, you know, sometimes this waiver process has been used as a recruitment mechanism. And I think that that's been the case this spring, because when the information got out about, you know, this waiver process potentially being modified for even the next academic year, I think that you probably had some coaches in some sports that were recruiting individuals that were in the transfer portal saying, hey, I think you can come here and be eligible immediately next year. You know, there's also been public pressure to support a departing student athlete's transfer waiver, and then subjective guidelines for relief, you know, encouraging creative waiver submission. And then there's just been an increased volume in talking to an NCAA staff member within the past month. I think that they received somewhere in the neighborhood of over 400 requests this past academic year. I mean, that's a lot of waivers. And, you know, these waivers have put a lot of pressure on compliance staffs around the country. But it's also put a lot of pressure on the NCAA staff, because these waivers are very complex. And in some ways, it has created some dissension between institutions, you know, because, you know, when one institution submits a waiver, you know, obviously before you submit it, sometimes you will, as a compliance individual, I will reach out to another institution to see whether, you know, they're going to support this waiver, because that's really part of the waiver process is what is the other institution, what is their view on this waiver? Do they support it? Do they not support it? And, you know, if there really isn't a level of support, then once an institution, you know, submits the waiver, then the institution that the student athlete left, you know, they have an opportunity to review basically everything that was submitted with the waiver for a 10-day period and provide a response to that waiver. So, you know, the waiver process has become contentious, and, you know, the environment's not sustainable. And so there was discussion even a month ago of, let's change the waiver process to allow people to be eligible in those five sports immediately next year. Well, after the board of directors met at the end of October, you know, they basically told the Division I Council, you are not going to vote to change this waiver process, or we're not going to change the waiver process for next year. What we need to do is we need to draft legislation to change the transfer rules in those five sports: men's, women's, basketball, football, baseball, and hockey. And so, you know, at this time, you know, this transfer waiver working group and the appropriate committees are working on changing the directives that go along with this waiver process. And really what we expect to see this summer is that legislation is going to be drafted for the one-time transfer to occur in those other five sports, like it has occurred in all other sports. You know, I think that they understand that they're going to see some waivers submitted this year because of the pandemic, because of COVID-19, and, you know, they're trying to develop, you know, some recommendations with respect to COVID-19 related cases. They're developing recommendations how to handle, you know, student athletes that were supposed to exhaust their eligibility in spring sports this year but have received a season of competition waiver, so now they could, you know, use their senior season all over again, whether it's at their current institution or really if they're going to transfer to another institution. And then, kind of as we've already talked about, they're developing, you know, some directives with respect to individuals that may have relied upon detrimental reliance, where because the word got out this spring that you may be able to transfer and be immediately eligible next year, you know, who was selling that to the student athlete? And so the student athlete may have decided to transfer because of information that may have been out there. And so, you know, that transfer waiver working group and the committees are just kind of preparing for the waivers to come this summer, next fall, and so forth.
So we wouldn't see the immediate eligibility until?
I would say that would not occur probably until the 2021-22 academic year. So if an individual were to transfer after the 2020-21 academic year, that they would potentially be eligible immediately in 2021-22.
So this is an attempt, if you're a fan and you're following college basketball and you say, well, player A at this school, they're eligible immediately. Player B at this other school, they're not. This was part of the attempt would be to address that kind of, I think what fans would see as an inconsistency or lack of transparency. You brought up the athletes, spring athletes, track, baseball, softball. Give us a snapshot on how that will play out as far as, I know, for example, Wichita State baseball. They've got three of their seniors who are planning on coming back. I know there's several track athletes who are planning on coming back. How does that change or affect what rosters are going to look like over the, you know, over 2020-2021?
So the spring sports student athletes did receive a season of competition waiver, which basically means that they receive their year back. And so, you know, when this pandemic first started, you know, late March, early April, you know, as a athletic department, you know, coaches of spring sports, we looked at who our seniors were, and obviously the coaches began having discussions with those student athletes of, do you want to come back and use this year of eligibility, or, you know, are you ready to move on with life after college? And so we do have seniors that are deciding to return. I believe women's golf has one senior that will return. Men's tennis, I believe, has three. Women's tennis, I believe, is four. Men's track and field, I believe, is three. Women's track is four or five. Softball is three. And as you mentioned, baseball, I believe, has three seniors coming back. And so some of the implications of that is, you know, you have normal scholarship limits in those sports. And the NCAA has provided the guidance and the flexibility that if those seniors decide to return, they will not count against the scholarship limits for the 2020-2021 academic year. And so you will see, you know, in some of our sports, you know, in women's tennis, it's generally you have eight scholarships, eight full ride scholarships. And so technically next year we may have more than eight individuals that are receiving a scholarship next year. You know, I think baseball is very unique. You know, baseball, traditionally you are only able to have 27 individuals on scholarship, and you have to declare a 35-man roster by this your first competition in the spring. You know, and I think that the ABCA, the Coaches Association for Baseball, has made some recommendations to the Division I Council to maybe provide more flexibility, you know, because, you know, with baseball, and really all the reasons a lot of this flexibility is occurring is because we've already signed student athletes in the fall to national letters of intent, and maybe even before the pandemic started. And so you're committed to those kids. You have seniors that want to come back. And so that's why flexibility is given. You know, with baseball, you have the major league draft that it's normally 40 rounds. It's only going to be five rounds this year. So you're not going to have as many student athletes leaving to go pro this year as what you would normally see. And so I know that baseball is asking, you know, even for more flexibility with respect to some NCAA rules than what has already been given. And, you know, we're kind of in a holding pattern to see what that may look like. You know, and, you know, they're wanting answers. We're wanting answers because with our returning student athletes, we have to notify them by July 1st whether their scholarship is being renewed for next year. And, you know, I know that, you know, Becky Endicott, Sarah Matthews, we're working on that. You know, normally we don't send those out until late June, until after the Board of Regents has approved tuition and fees for the next academic year. But we've kind of already started that process, and we're almost to the conclusion of it. But there's some sports that we haven't sent those financial aid agreements out, like baseball, because we're kind of waiting to see, particularly in baseball, what's going to happen with some of the normal NCAA rules.
And this would have implications not only for the athletes coming back, but it will also have implications for incoming freshmen who say, you know, I thought I was going to walk in and be the starting shortstop. Now all of a sudden there's a senior shortstop coming back. Is there a sense, how is that playing out with maybe newcomers to schools?
You know, I think, you know, some sports, you know, kind of fill up their signing class in the fall. And so I think some of our rosters may be bigger next year than what they normally are. You have some sports that had not concluded signing, and so, you know, sports like tennis, they hadn't filled their allotments of scholarships for next year. And so, you know, their roster size may be very comparable to what it's been in the past. You know, I think, you know, by seniors coming back, kind of what it's done is, you know, not only are seniors coming back, but, you know, your student athletes that were freshmen, sophomores, and juniors this year in those spring sports, they are basically coming back as freshmen, sophomores, and juniors again next year. And so, you know, your classes are larger. So it you know, it's going to be an interesting year or 2 years to see how some of these rosters play out. And, you know, it makes you wonder, are you going to see more transfers a year or two from now? I mean, is that just going to be a natural progression of things, you know, because you have bigger rosters? Is there going to be some transition in future years as a result of the pandemic and having some bigger rosters next year?
Thank you for listening to the Roundhouse Podcast, courtesy of Wichita State University Strategic Communications. We appreciate your time. We encourage you to rate, review, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, such as on iTunes or Google Play. You can find more Roundhouse content at GoShockers.com. Thank you for listening.
And they let him pass it up court, and then it gets picked off. A long three by Pangos. No good. 1 second. It's over. It is over, and Wichita State has beaten the number one team in the nation to go to the Sweet 16. Go crazy, Wichita. I know you.